Here we go with the takeaway for April 17th. The U.S. is on track to have the worst measles outbreak in 20 years, and New York City is now mandating vaccines in certain areas.
I'm a strong believer in vaccination. However, I don't believe the government should force parents to vaccinate their kids.
What's one more regulation if it's for the greater good?
We talk about the ethics of mandatory vaccinations. Also on the show, people across Indonesia went to the polls earlier today in the world's largest single-day election.
We've seen elephants bringing polling booths to people, people trekking through jungles and using boats to make sure that most people today seem to have been able to have their vote.
And a case over whether South Dakota can execute a man who is mentally ill could have broad implications.
If states start to pass these bills, just the sheer number of people facing the death penalty and getting executed every year will slowly over time tick down.
Let's get to it. It's been nearly 20 years since the Center for Disease Control announced the United States had eliminated measles. But today, we've made an about-face. From California to Texas, 20 states have reported measles cases, and the country is back on track to have the worst measles outbreak in nearly two decades. But about 65% of current cases are here in New York State, where the outbreaks are mostly concentrated in ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities in Brooklyn and Rockland County. In response, New York officials have made efforts to force residents in certain zip codes to vaccinate their children or keep unvaccinated children home. Some families have sued over the measure. New York currently allows parents to claim a religious exemption to opt their child out of the vaccine requirements. And it's just the latest chapter in a long history of fighting over vaccinations in the United States, and where public health, freedom of religion, and politics converge. To help us break this down, we've got Gwen Hogan reporting on the measles outbreak in New York for WNYC, and she joins me here in studio. Gwen, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tanzina.
And Arthur Kaplan is director of the Division of Medical Ethics at the New York University School of Medicine. Art, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tanzina.
So, Gwen, let's start with you. What is spurring these outbreaks across the country? Is it a lack of vaccinations? Is it fear? Is it how contagious this disease is? What is it?
It's a little bit of all of those things. We've seen outbreaks, like you mentioned, in many different states. Washington, California, Michigan, and then New York and New Jersey have been the largest outbreaks. Public health officials have said there is a trend towards vaccine hesitancy that comes with this propagation of anti-vaccination propaganda that's spread on social media, that's spread through books, that's spread through pamphlets. And we're definitely seeing this here in New York. Like you mentioned, 65% of the measles cases so far have happened in New York within this ultra-Orthodox religious community here.
So let's drill down a little bit there, because there are specific things happening within specific communities. What's happening in the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community in New York? What's that cluster all about?
It's a couple different factors. On the one hand, there has been a slight decrease in immunization rates within yeshivas in New York City, but that alone doesn't explain what's happening. This community, as one person that I spoke to described, that doesn't have traditional borders the way others do. There's family in Israel. There's family all over the globe. And so because of frequent travel to places where they're ongoing measles outbreak, somebody gets sick abroad, they bring it back, and then it spreads to others because there's a threshold of unvaccinated people within the community.
You also mentioned, when I think about people who are anti-vax, if you will, or people who are not vaccinating their children, I think about very different communities. And you're saying that a lot of the information that different communities are getting is coming from the same place?
It's a little more nuanced than that, but the movement, there is a fringe, very small group of anti-vaccination activists within the ultra-Orthodox community who are of the community, but they have links to the national anti-vaccination movement through multiple sources, and some of their propaganda that they've created for their community is influenced by other national organizations, the same information that is being spread to secular anti-vaccination movement.
Art, let's bring you in here, because we need a dose of medical ethics at this point, I think. How have we seen, or how are you seeing this moment on this outbreak addressed by public health officials?
Well, in New York, in Rockland County, and in the city, public health officials have said, look, we have the danger of a huge epidemic. We've got to get on top of it, and we've got to be tough in terms of making sure that people get vaccinated. So normally, vaccination is kind of a, you do it, and if you want to opt out on religious grounds, that's tolerated. But once you get this epidemic underway, the public officials, health department, mayors, county officials, rightly in my view, start to say, we've got to stop this epidemic. Remember, there are a lot of people who can't vaccinate, newborns, some people due to health conditions. They're likely to get the measles and suffer a lot if they do. So we're going to up the ante and say, we're going to fine you. We're going to shut your school if you're not getting vaccinated. It's starting to put the regulatory emphasis on protecting the community, not protecting the individual's rights.
And I want to talk a little bit about that tension there, because that feels like it's really undermining a lot of what we're talking about. We got a bunch of calls from some of our listeners, and I want to play two of them so you can kind of hear where people are coming from.
My name is Joe, and I'm calling from New York, New York. I'm a strong believer in vaccination. However, I don't believe the government should force parents to vaccinate their kids. We've been arguing for decades in support of my body, my choice.
I mean, I believe in freedom of choice for a lot of things, but when you put other people in harm's way, where does it stop? What's one more regulation if it's for the greater good?
So, Art, we have two really interesting points here. We see people who say, you know, should the government force parents to vaccinate their kids? And then it's a question of, well, where does the personal extend into the public, right? What do you see, Art?
Well, first of all, I don't think the vaccine police are coming to your house to drag the kids out in the street to vaccinate them yet. That could happen if the epidemic swirled completely out of control. But now we're penalizing, closing schools, telling people they better not be in public places if they haven't vaccinated. So the way I would see the ethical balance is this. Your freedom to choose and control what happens to you is great. It doesn't extend to everything about your children. For example, a car seat. We don't care what your views are about car seats. We don't care whether you think there's a plot by car seat manufacturers to sell them to everybody. We know the evidence shows that kids are protected by car seats. You put them in there or you get a fine. And the protection of someone who can't protect their own health trumps the right to control your body. Similarly, if you're putting the entire community at risk, remember, measles is one of the most infectious diseases there is, way more than Ebola and SARS and Zika diseases we hear about a lot, much more infectious. You've got to protect the community and the vulnerable people there. So it's a tough trade-off, but I think you lean toward protecting children and protecting the community that can't protect themselves.
There are still other pieces to this equation. Gwen, in your reporting, you spoke to a mother named Esther. Let's take a listen to what she had to say.
We always prided ourselves in the ability to choose what's right for our children. And it's terrible to hear that that choice might be removed from us.
Tell us about Esther.
Yeah, she was with a group of mothers who were opposed to vaccines, who were right outside this press conference last week where the city announced a mandatory vaccination rule. And they were saying their children had gotten the measles. And they said, as soon as I knew that my child was sick, I kept them home. I treated them well. I, you know, cared for them dutifully. They weren't exposing. They said they weren't exposing anybody else to the measles. But again, it's so contagious that it's really hard to know if that's the case when we live in really close quarters in New York City.
We're talking about the measles outbreaks in the United States and especially here in New York with medical ethicist Art Kaplan and reporter Gwen Hogan of WNYC. Gwen, I mentioned that New York State has a religious exemption for vaccination requirements. And Art, I'm going to ask you for your thoughts on that as well, because that does seem to bump up against what we're talking about, the greater good versus the individual. But Gwen, how does this religious exemption square with these measures like keeping kids home from school?
Well, there is this inherent contradiction, and people who study public health law say you're sending mixed messages when on the state level you say you can have a religious exemption, but then on the local level there's an outbreak, so now you can't, or your child can't go to school, or they have to stay indoors. And so there is a push now in New York to reconsider this religious exemption.
Art, your thoughts on that? Is there room for things like a religious exemption when it comes to things like vaccinations with contagious diseases?
Well, first, let me just say, Tanzina, you are able to spread the disease 4 days before you see symptoms. So I know parents say they keep their kids home when they're sick, but that's not going to cut the mustard in terms of protecting people. In terms of religious exemptions, a lot of states permit them, but I don't think they make any sense because major religions, including Judaism, don't oppose vaccination. If you looked at what Catholics and Muslims and Buddhists and Hindus and whoever has to say about vaccination, they're pro-vaccination. But I think that religious exemptions ought to be eliminated. They don't make any sense in terms of what religions teach, and they've led to the outbreaks that we're seeing.
So, Art, let's take this even a step further back to give it some context here. When did vaccination fighting really begin in the United States? I mean, do we have a history of this?
Oh, yeah. Long, long history. Smallpox used to be a horrible disease that, you know, wiped out Native Americans when colonialists came to the Western Hemisphere, but remained a horrible disease. And inoculation really was driven in public health by the ability to see that something that was generated from a cow, a similar disease, cowpox, could confer protection against smallpox. But manufacturing that vaccine back in 1902, it wasn't as safe. You could get sick. A lot of people worried about safety, and I have to say then, rightly so. And so even though there were mandates with the police coming to vaccinate you, literally, in cities like Philadelphia, for example, which had a major outbreak, people still said, I'm not going to do it. And we went to court, and the Supreme Court ruled way back in a case called Jacobson versus Massachusetts that public health authorities do have the right to mandate vaccination.
Now, it seems as though, you know, we've gotten, as a country, we've gotten smarter about these diseases. I just mentioned at the top of the show, about 20 years ago, we thought we had eradicated measles from the United States. And yet, it seems like the anti-vax movement, if you will, Art, is even intensifying. How does that square with the science?
It doesn't square with the science. Vaccination for diseases like measles and the flu, which come around all the time and are highly infectious, you have to keep doing it. You can't let your guard down. This country's let its guard down. By the way, there are massive outbreaks in Madagascar, Ukraine, Italy, Madagascar, and they're only a plane flight away. As Gwen said earlier, you know, you can bring those diseases right back here if we're not vaccinating. The other part of the science is there are safety concerns. But again, study after study after study, the big concern is autism. It just doesn't link. There was a study actually last week out of Denmark funded by the Danish government of 600,000 kids over 10 years. They found no association between vaccination and autism. But those things live on the internet. They're hard to get out of people's minds when they don't know what's causing autism. So sadly, that science gets undercut.
Gwen, we've got about 15 seconds left. You're continuing to look at this story. Where are you headed next?
Well, both New York City and Rockland County will be in court later this week. And I'll be following up with a group of nurses who are sort of trying to fight the anti-vaccination propaganda within their community. So I'll be looking at that, too.
Gwen Hogan is a reporter for WNYC covering this issue. And Art Kaplan is director of the Division of Medical Ethics at the New York University School of Medicine. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Earlier today in Indonesia, voters across 17,000 islands went to the polls. The incumbent President Joko Widodo pulled ahead into an early lead over former General Prabowo Subianto. Official results are expected to take weeks. The country has nearly 190 million eligible voters, making Election Day a massive undertaking for Indonesia's government. And with fake news swirling and divisiveness on the rise, a grassroots group is stepping in to make sure the results are fair. I'm joined now by Rebecca Henschke, an editor at BBC Asia and longtime correspondent in Indonesia. Rebecca, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you very much.
So there are two candidates for president here. They come from very different backgrounds and have a very different approach to politics. Can you tell us about President Joko and what his record's been?
Well, he came to politics through a very unusual route. He was a carpenter and then a local mayor and then the mayor of Jakarta, the capital, and then he became president. So it was a historic election last time around for him because he was the first Indonesian president not to come from the military or the political elite. He was very much seen as a man of the people. Now, the person who's challenging him, Prabowo Subianto, is from that elite. He was the former son-in-law of Suharto, who ruled Indonesia for 32 years. He's a very wealthy man. So the two from polar opposite ends of the kind of economic as well as the social spectrum in Indonesia.
And beyond the personalities of the two, what were the big issues here for Indonesians you've spoken to?
Well, both candidates have very similar policies, really. It's really about the kind of the identity they represent. But for people on the ground in Indonesia, the key issues is the economy, jobs. President Joko Widodo has sort of embarked on a very ambitious infrastructure push, which he was selling to people. He's been building roads and ports and new trains in a way that Indonesia hasn't seen before. And people were interested in that. And they were looking at that. But in order to do this infrastructure building, he's also done deals with the Chinese investment groups as well as Japan. And so there has been issues in this campaign about foreign workers, a lot of fake news about the number of Chinese workers in the region. And that's something Prabowo Subianto has picked up on. So in his rallies, he's been talking about the country being sold to outsiders, to foreigners, not specifically saying Chinese, but really meaning that and saying that he would have a much more nationalistic economic policy, talking about food securities, issues that people do care about.
Rebecca, we mentioned at the top of the segment here that there is a grassroots effort to make sure that every vote is accurate and counted. Why was this necessary? You just mentioned the concern about fake news. Was that part of what this was about?
There has been a huge amount of fake news. Indonesia is a big user of social media. One of the top Twitter capitals in the world is Jakarta, Facebook. And we've seen from both teams, unofficially and somewhat officially, spreading a lot of fake news. So these groups that are monitoring the election closely are aware of this kind of fake news, this divisive campaign that has been run in this multi-ethnic, multi-religious society that is largely very tolerant and peaceful, to make sure that nothing gets out of hand. And what we have seen today is a very successful election across a huge, vast archipelago, 17,000 islands. We've seen elephants bringing polling booths to people, people trekking through jungle and using boats to make sure that most people today seem to have been able to have their vote. And those votes are being counted very quickly now. We're getting a very clear, quick count.
So, Rebecca, when do we expect an official vote tally for Indonesia's presidential election? We know it could take at least several weeks, right?
The official results will be a few weeks, but already we have reliable, quick counts that have come out from the polling stations, and most reputable polling stations or polling teams have President Joko Widodo, you know, a good 10% ahead of Prabowo Subianto. So it's looking at this stage like President Joko Widodo has held on to the presidency for another term. But of course, he's saying to his supporters, we need to wait and see for that official result. Although they're celebrating at the moment in their offices and on the streets. From the other side, Prabowo has come out and said that according to him, his internal quick count teams show that he actually won the election, and his team is telling people to stay vigilant for this not to be taken away from them, but at the same time telling his supporters to stay calm, to be not provoked to carry out any violent acts. But we are also seeing Prabowo supporters openly crying because they think this is over.
Is there a sense that the independent monitors and checks influence the election for better or worse?
No, I think Indonesia's democracy is in a very good shape. I mean, if you look around the region, what's happened today really shows that Indonesia is the star in terms of democracy in Southeast Asia. It's been a very free and fair election. Indonesians talk about it being a pesta democracy, which means a democratic party. a celebration. And today we've really seen that at polling stations. Many of the officials have dressed up in costumes. So we had one superheroes, another ghosts. Someone else was all dressed up in school uniforms to make sure that people had fun voting today. And across this vast archipelago, most people were. I mean, there were some issues in the very remote areas of Papua, where those around 300 polling stations will have to vote again tomorrow. But it's unlikely that those number of votes would swing the presidential election. But at the same time today, we're seeing legislative and local elections all on the one day. So this is the world's most complex election ever.
You mentioned sort of at the federal level how things had changed in Indonesia, but in terms of local municipalities and local communities there, is there still a heavy military presence, and are there still concerns, particularly among LGBT Indonesians, about their own safety and their ability to get to the polls?
Well, the community, the LGBT community, has seen rising persecution in Indonesia over recent years, which is tied to this growing empowering of the far-right Islamic groups in the country. But they were definitely able to vote today. And there's no part of Indonesia that has heavy military presence other than the province of Papua, where there is a low-running separatist battle. But people there, again, were able to vote. I mean, Indonesia has given a lot of political power to local leaders as part of its sort of opening up of democracy. That's come with moves forwards as well as moves backwards, according to analysts. And we have seen a lot of corruption across the country. There's also a lot of issues about corruption within politics in terms of vote buying and how candidates go about trying to win elections at local levels, who they team up with, what they make promises to. So at that level, there are a lot of issues, and corruption in politics is still huge.
All right. A lot of information there on Indonesian elections from Rebecca Henschke with BBC Asia. Rebecca, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. In 2016, a 24-year-old man in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, named Heath Otto, committed two brutal murders. He killed his own mother and his 7-year-old nephew and was charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder, charges that make him eligible for the death penalty. But Heath Otto hasn't gone to trial yet.
Since then, it's come out that over the course of the months leading up to the murders, he had exhibited really clear sort of signs of psychosis, walking into banks and talking about the CIA, throwing things, saying, "I need help."
That's Maurice Chamaux, a staff writer for the Marshall Project. And his latest piece, published today, highlights the complexities of Otto's case.
His mother struggled to get him into some form of treatment, but when they would get close to treatment, he would sort of flip the switch and refuse to go. And she was sort of in an increasingly desperate situation in the weeks leading up to this. And then this tragedy struck, and now the rest of the family is kind of picking up the pieces.
Maurice and I discussed Otto's case and how it fits into this country's handling of mentally ill people who commit crimes.
He is currently in a state hospital in South Dakota, and the question that looms over this case is whether he's going to face the death penalty. It's my understanding that the state's attorney in the town told the family that that was a possibility, and now the family, members of their family, are pushing very hard for him not to get the death penalty. And so we're waiting for his mental condition to stabilize, for this question to get resolved, and this sort of clicks in with a larger national movement and question around whether people with serious mental illnesses should face capital punishment.
This is a really unique question in that not should it be the death penalty at all, but should anyone with mental illness be sentenced to death? And I guess I sort of thought that we had already decided that as a nation. And so that hasn't happened, has it?
No, not at all. Occasionally, you'll see cases where the Supreme Court will get involved over the question of someone who's been on death row for many years and who has come to exhibit clear signs of mental illness doesn't understand why they're being executed. And the Supreme Court has dealt with the question of when the execution comes up, what we should do with somebody who is in a, very clear state of mental illness. But Over the last few decades, the Supreme Court has also said that certain categories of people shouldn't get the death penalty. People with intellectual disabilities, people who were under the age of 18. There's this idea that criminal culpability, as we understand it, is a little more limited in certain kinds of cases when certain factors are at play. Now, as the death penalty declines overall, there are still a lot of people who would say, well, I'm not ready to abandon the death penalty for good, but I would say that it should only affect people who are clearly the worst of the worst, as defined, you know, in courtrooms or by juries. The problem is that a lot of cases involving serious mental illness are, on the face of them, very terrifying. I mean, Heath Otto tried to strangle his mother and his 7-year-old nephew with a phone cord, and then he slit their throats. When the police got there, he said that they were needing medical treatment and he wanted to put them out of their misery, you know, things that really didn't make any sense. And this is a case that, kind of on the front page of the paper, sounds very scary. But once you peel back the layers and understand what he was going through, the question is whether he should be in one of these categories of people who didn't understand what they were doing and who should be protected from this ultimate punishment.
Which states around the country are looking to abolish the death penalty for mentally ill people?
There are bills floating around the legislatures in Virginia. It passed the state Senate there, in Texas, in Ohio, and I believe in Tennessee and Missouri. South Dakota, where Heath Otto lives, this bill has come up in the legislature there, and it was very recently rejected, though it's my understanding it will come up again next year. What's going to be interesting to watch is whether South Dakota, Texas, Missouri, some of these states you really associate with having the death penalty and with really believing in it as a policy matter, are willing to carve out and say this group of people should be protected, shouldn't get the death penalty. And ultimately, the result of that will be a winnowing of the death penalty to where instead of 10 cases a year, we're hearing about one case a year. This is something prosecutors have said that they're concerned about. They think of these bills, these limitations on the death penalty, as kind of a backdoor effort. They think everyone will come and get a mental health diagnosis and avoid the death penalty that way. It's hard to tell whether that would happen, but I do think it's safe to say that if states start to pass these bills, just the sheer number of people facing the death penalty and getting executed every year will slowly over time tick down to where we're talking about this stuff, you know, once every 12 months instead of once every month.
A lot of what we see across the country often is that there is a dearth of mental health services. Mm-hmm. And often those who are severely mentally ill who do commit crimes end up incarcerated when often that's because of a lack of adequate medical services to committing this crime. Was that the case here?
Yes, very much so. Sioux Falls, South Dakota is a small town. South Dakota is one of many states where people who need to go to a state hospital and take one of the beds there wait a very long time for it. Heath Otto himself never saw a therapist, and his family was trying to get him help. Now, part of that was that there weren't a lot of mental health resources, especially outpatient. Part of it was also that the laws are written in a way that really defers to the wishes of the person at issue, unless they are deemed a threat to themselves or others. Police can't just go and take them and commit them, which on the surface sounds like a good idea. But in this case, his behavior was increasingly erratic, increasingly scary, and concerning to his family, and they wanted him to get help. And there was very limited kind of outpatient treatment options in their part of South Dakota.
And how often are mentally ill criminalized when what they need is mental health services? Do we know?
There's all kinds of data tracking this. For the most part, we know that with the rise of sort of deinstitutionalization in the 70s, the emptying of mental health institutions, jails and prisons became kind of the de facto institutions for people with those sorts of health issues. So, you know, the sheriff of Chicago has said, you know, I basically run a mental health facility, not a jail. And you see this in a lot of jails and prisons, that there are just lots and lots of people, diagnosed, undiagnosed, whose behavior grew erratic and whose ability to kind of fit into society was challenged. And so they ended up committing a crime, whether a small one or a big one in this case, and they ended up in prison.
It's not an easy thing to talk about, but what ends up happening to Otto?
So he thought his family would like for him to be confined to a state hospital. They told me, frankly, that they don't think that their loved one really will ever be safe out on the street again. But they think that if he were to be saved from the death penalty but go to a general population prison, that he would not get the kinds of help that they think that he needs to stabilize. Already he's been in a state hospital for a couple of years, and they told me it's taken quite a while for him to have the medication and the routine such that he, you know, at least in a day-to-day way, can kind of take care of himself. And then once his condition stabilizes, the court will determine whether he's competent to stand trial. And at that point, the state's attorney, Aaron McGowan, in Minnehaha County in South Dakota, will have to decide whether to seek the death penalty in the case. Several of his family members are begging the state's attorney not to, though his sister, the mother of one of the victims, the 7-year-old Braden Otto, does want the death penalty, thinks he knew what he was doing, and deserves this ultimate punishment for it. So it's a very complicated family dynamic, but this very painful drama will come to play out in a courtroom. And if he does not get the death penalty and the prosecutor does not allow him to be contained in a state hospital, then he will face effectively life in a regular prison.
Maurice Shema is a staff writer for The Marshall Project. You can read his latest story on themarshallproject.org, released today. Maurice, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.